Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 16th of April. This hour of the program, we talk about North Korea, and we'll be looking at all that's been happening this week. On Tuesday of this week, North Korea said that it would permanently pull out of nuclear disarmament talks and start their nuclear program again. The United Nations Security Council charged that North Korea had violated a United Nations resolution. And we have yet another foreign policy dilemma for the new administration here in the United States and what it is we can do to deal with this very unusual, strange, probably the strangest country on the face of this earth. How do we deal with their peculiarities and their threat, and how real is the threat? We have a wonderful guest who's joining us by phone from Seoul. He has Wisconsin connections and Korea connections as well. Professor Ed Reed is Korea representative for the Asia Foundation, where he's been since 2004. He focuses on international relations, partnerships for Asian development, and North Korea exchanges and trainings. He was also associate director of the Center for East Asia Studies at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He was a Peace Corps volunteer in Korea in the early 70s and a Fulbright researcher at Seoul National University. He is with us the first hour of our program today. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we can take emails today if you'd like to send us an email. That address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Ed Reed, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning. I'm glad to be with you.
Hi. It's a long way from Madison to Seoul, isn't it?
Yes, but you sound very close, so
I know.
Shouldn't be any problem.
Yeah, so do you. You sound very close. Tell me, this seems to me to be the most unusual, strange, peculiar country on the face of the earth, North Korea, and it's been called that. Is it very strange?
Well, yes, by many international standards, it is strange, but I have visited there quite a few times, and I can assure you that ordinary human beings do live in North Korea, and most of them are getting by as best they can, just as people do everywhere. But the regime itself, the leadership, is a kind of fusion of some sort of traditional medieval regime plus a socialist state headed by a single family, but in any case, quite deeply entrenched, and has been isolated, and has isolated its population from the world for several generations. So it's not surprising that it acts in some strange ways.
When you talk about it, Professor Reed, being a traditional medieval regime, I'm not sure I've heard it being described that way. What does that mean?
Well, I guess I should say a kind of feudal regime. You have an autocratic, authoritarian leader. People are divided into different classes. People who are working, for example, in the agricultural sector cannot just move around or move to a city. You're assigned a job to, and you stay there. It's also built around a cult of almost worship of the leaders. The founding leader, the father, the current leader, is worshipped in a godlike way. His son is also held up as almost a demigod. And so it's not just an ordinary socialist state that we had gotten used to during the Cold War, but it has its own very peculiar characteristics as well.
Do the people there have any access to the outside world? Is there internet? Are there broadcasts, international broadcasts, or not?
No, there are not. The state takes steps to prevent people from having access to any news except what it provides. And it used to be fairly absolute in its isolation. There is still no internet connection. Ordinary people cannot receive international mail or make international phone calls. There are no international media or newspapers. Nevertheless, over the last 10 years or so, it appears that information has been leaking in to the country, both through people moving back and forth across the border with China, visitors, people who are there monitoring aid delivery. There have been visitors from North Korea out, quite a few to China and a few to the United States. So more information is getting in, but it's still, by any standard, very isolated.
And tell me about your visits to North Korea. Were they academic visits? What was the purpose?
I've been working with humanitarian aid organizations, and at one point with World Vision, and now with the Asia Foundation. In the case of World Vision, during the 90s, I headed a program that was providing some food aid, but also agricultural assistance to help increase food production in North Korea. So I was able to visit a number of collective farms in different parts of the country and get a pretty good idea of the conditions there during the height of the famine in 1996 to 98. More recently, the organization I work with organizes educational opportunities for North Korean scholars and scientists to visit the United States or to participate in trainings in China or elsewhere in the region. And we've been able to do this off and on for the last 10 years or so.
Is food still scarce in North Korea?
Yes, it is. And the main reason for that is that North Korea's position on the globe is not one that allows it to grow enough food for its people. It really should import perhaps one-fourth or one-third of the food it needs. And to do that, it needs to have trade with the rest of the world in order to get the foreign exchange to purchase food. As you know, most countries engage in trade and purchase at least some of their food from outside the country. The problem is that the leadership of North Korea pushed the ecology very far in order to try to make the country self-reliant in food production. And basically, it seriously damaged the ecology and have trouble even growing a modest amount of food. But the bottom line is they really should not grow all the food they need. They should produce enough that can sustain the ecology and then import the rest, which means opening up to trade with the rest of the world.
And is there trade, and if so, how significant is it with China?
There's been some slow increase in trade over the last 10 years, but and China is its primary trading partner, but most of the trade is very small scale. North Korea exports minerals. It's rich in some minerals and exports that, but doesn't have very much else to export. It doesn't have much factory production, for example, to export. And it imports very basic needs like oil for running its industries and its electricity and food. So it has very low level of trade.
Let's talk about the actions of this week. North Korea is saying that it would permanently pull out of the nuclear disarmament talks. Can you give me a history of those talks, please, Professor Reed? How long they've been going on, and what prompted the North Korean action?
Well, it's a long story.
That's all right. We have time.
But we'll try to get summarize it.
Okay.
The most recent talks, called the six parties talks because it involved the six countries of the U.S. And North Korea, of course, but South Korea, China, Russia, and Japan. And these talks have been going on for about 5 years. But the efforts to negotiate an end to the North Korean nuclear program go back to 1993.
Oh my.
And there was an agreement in 94 that actually shut down their nuclear plant up until 2002. So for 8 years, their program was frozen under a prior agreement. But this fell apart in 2002, and there were reasons for that. They were accused by the Bush administration of reneging on that deal by trying to start an alternative uranium enrichment program. There's some doubts about whether this program was ever actually started. But in any case, the North Koreans reacted by pulling out of that 1994 agreement and restarting their nuclear power plant that produces plutonium. And it's the latest effort, the six-party talks, are an effort to again close that plant and go all the way to total denuclearization of North Korea. Some progress has been made. In September 2005, an agreement was signed by the six parties that laid out a three-step program for eliminating North Korea's nuclear program. And they have moved along the line. There was a pause when things broke down and North Korea actually tested a nuclear device in the fall of 2006, basically to demonstrate that it did have something that it of value to give up.
Right.
And things paused, but then started again in early 2007, and up until late last year, progress continued, but finally broke down on how intrusive the inspections would be of North Korea by international and United States inspectors. And this broke down just in the last year, things just were in a holding pattern, and with this rocket launch has basically, North Korea has made a statement that it's still strong, it still has a powerful deterrent, as they call it, and that the other parties need to continue to negotiate and offer a good deal. So that's sort of where we stand now.
I would imagine North Korea would think that pretty much anything was intrusive for a country that is so remarkably blocked off.
That's right. Nevertheless, during the period when their power plant was shut down, and over the last couple of years, inspectors have been on the site of that their one nuclear power plant, which was being dismantled. And as you know, they were just asked to leave in the last few days. So in terms of the production of plutonium by a power plant, this they have allowed inspection of. What they were balking at was inspection of their weapons production systems, their missile systems, and other aspects of the program that might be scattered in other parts of the country. And for this, they felt it was going too far.
And what do they get in exchange? I mean, things are different right now, but in order to allow the inspectors in, what were they getting in exchange? Food or what?
In the agreement signed a couple of years ago by the six parties, they were getting a massive amount of energy aid in the form of heavy fuel oil to run their electric power plants. They were also getting food aid, and they had the promise of what might be called development assistance. In other words, to try to assist them in getting their economy going again, which has more or less collapsed. It did not get to that point. And if the whole process had been completed, the United States had definitely offered to negotiate establishing normal diplomatic relations with the North if they got to the point of verifiably giving up their nuclear program. So they were getting some preliminary assistance, Some of it went in slowly, and there were always problems in coordinating this assistance from various parties in the six-party talks. But in the long term, their interest was apparently to have normal relations with the United States, which would open, they thought, development assistance. We did not reach this point yet.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We will take them in just a moment. We have yet to talk about the recent missile launching. What was that missile? What was the purpose of it? Was it just a puny attempt at trying to show some kind of strength, or was it significant? Does it indicate a risk to the rest of the world? Edward Reed is our guest. Professor Reed has been the Korea representative of the Asia Foundation for quite a few years now. He also served as Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He was a Peace Corps volunteer in Korea in the early 70s. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. We should also say that he was County Director for North Korea for World Vision International until 2000, where he developed and managed a $4 million program of relief, rehabilitation, and agricultural assistance in North Korea. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Our email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Professor Reed, and let's start with Mike from Appleton. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
What seems to me, to kind of summarize what the professor said, is that for the last 10 years, for over a decade, we've been dealing with the Koreans, and basically they've been playing us for fools. What they're trying to do is gain as much time as possible. I have no doubt that they would sell their technology to anybody in order to get hard cash. They were involved with the Syrians. They're involved with the Iranians. They're developing this missile technology. There were Iranians present when that missile was launched. And, you know, we keep on trying to, I guess, I don't know what the word is, appease or give them more time or, you know, I don't know what it is. But we probably should have done. And this is also, you know, constantly under the threat of grave steps on the part of the Koreans if anybody, you know, messes with them. So what we should probably have done when that missile was sitting on the pad is send in two cruise missiles and take it out and call their bluff. I don't think the Koreans are stupid. I think they, you know, were they going to invade South Korea because we did something like that? I think that I think the time has come to call their bluff.
Professor Reed.
Yeah. Well, I think your position is very understandable. A lot of people are terribly frustrated with trying to deal with North Korea and solve this problem. However, the people who live here on the Korean Peninsula, here in South Korea, for example, including myself, their top priority, understandably, is to avoid another war on this peninsula, which would just be horrific. And if they can coax North Korea along until this regime ends its life, naturally in some way without an explosion, this is what they would prefer. The threat, so then that's fine, though, unless they are threatening the rest of the world in some way. This missile launch in itself, I don't believe, altered the security situation in any significant way. They spent a lot of their fortune, which they don't have much of, and could have used for purchasing food and other things, to produce this one missile and lob it out into the Pacific. They didn't even know where it went. They had to wait for the U.S. and others to tell them where it went because they don't have the technology to follow it. So it's not in itself an arsenal or a new weapon. It does show that they have technology, as you say, could be marketed perhaps. But I think we should not overestimate their threat. We should very closely monitor and prevent proliferation of any nuclear material and of dangerous missile technology. You're correct. They have been working with a number of countries in this regard. Most of that has been detected. Some of it shut down. The U.S. now has something called the Proliferation Security Initiative to try to interdict and monitor transfer of any technology. So I guess the goal is to prevent a a greater evil, which might be a war on this peninsula and in the region, while basically waiting out the end of this really failed regime and failed economy.
Do you think that we are overestimating their threat?
I think it's a danger. I don't think that it is a threat in the sense that North Korea is going to go to war with South Korea or attack anyone. The danger is, A, proliferation. Selling out of desperation, selling what it has to keep its regime alive. And that's what we can prevent, because all of that has to cross borders and travel a long way. China is extremely concerned about that issue, and they are the closest, they are on the border of North Korea and have cooperating with the U.S. on this, and I think it can be shut down. The second great danger is a chaotic collapse of North Korea that could create instability while they still have a very large military and very dangerous conventional and local theater weapons that could fall in the wrong hands. So I think those two things we need to manage and control. It would be very attractive to take out, say, for that one missile that was sitting on the launch pad. But I think that would almost have played into the hands of North Korea. Personally, I do.
Thank you, Mike, for your call. We go next to Joe from Green Bay. Hi, Joe.
Hello, good morning.
Hi.
And good morning, Professor Reed. This is a very interesting topic to me. I was stationed in Seoul, Korea, in the military a decade ago.
Uh-huh.
And we heard rumors even then about the level of propaganda that was flying around in North Korea concerning, you know, the rest of the world, the rest of the free world.
Yes.
I was just wondering, what kind of blanket, you know, do they have over them? What do they really believe about the rest of the world? Because when the rumors that we were told was that the general public up there believes that the rest of the world is out to get them. It's completely the opposite. You know, everybody here is so scared to death of North Korea maybe launching an attack. And I heard that it's the polar opposite over there, that they feed them the line that we are constantly trying to take them over. Kill their children.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just, so it was kind of crazy. I was wondering if you knew the level of propaganda or what, you know, just their general thoughts about the rest of the world. And also if the public up there being as blind to the rest of the world as they are, is the administration the same way, or do they really know what's going on in the rest of the world? They just don't want to show their people this.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Starting with your last point, that the leadership certainly knows that they have fallen way behind the rest of the world. However, I do think they feel threatened, and they should. The head of the regime in North Korea, if that regime were to collapse, if people were to know the truth about the rest of the world and what has been done to them, the leadership would be in serious trouble. And their way of dealing with that is to convince the population that the country is under continual threat. They have been under war mobilization for years and years. And so every time South Korea or the United States or Japan makes any statement or conducts any military exercises, such as ones you may have participated here in South Korea, the North uses this as a demonstration of hostility and again tells its people that they're about to be invaded. So it's used as a method of control. Now, how much do ordinary people in North Korea buy this? How much do they know about the outside world? I would say 10 years ago, they knew very little, and they had almost no source of information except what they were being told. Over the last few years, though, this has changed, and more information has trickled in. For example, one of the favorite pastimes now in North Korea is to watch DVDs of South Korean television dramas.
Oh, my.
And, yeah, these are traded around in North Korea quietly. And people who have escaped the North or fled to the South talk about this. So even the political authorities and the police are quite interested in watching these films. And also stories about how well people live in China. It's well known now. So actually the regime in the North has changed its story a little bit. It says people elsewhere are living better than we are. However, we are maintaining the purity of the Korean people and the real culture. We have not been polluted by Westernization and American culture like the South. We don't have great differences in wealth and among our people, and we have to fight hard to maintain this, and we have to sacrifice. After the missile launch, Kim Jong-il was quoted in the media in North Korea, in the main and only newspaper, saying that he regretted that the money spent on that missile could not be spent to buy food, but he knew the people would understand. So this their story is changing a bit, but it's still quite isolated.
And the people said, oh, yes, we understand. No
yes,
food,
yes.
But we love the missile.
It was a delicious missile, actually.
It must have been. When you talk about the possibility of chaotic collapse, is North Korea fairly close to this? Because Kim Jong-il is not very well. I don't know how popular his son is, but it seems as though the government is rather precarious.
Very much. And one of the theories to explain the very belligerent behavior recently is that in the North, they are faced with a transition or a succession of some kind very soon, and they know that. About a month ago, a photograph was published in the Workers' Party paper in North Korea and then shown around the world of Kim Jong-il inspecting a new swimming pool. And the picture of him showed him in extremely bad health. I mean, you know, you would say almost on death's door, and his clothes hanging off of him. And the question was, why did the North Korean media, totally controlled by the state, put out this photograph? Now, recently, a few days ago, when he appeared at the opening of their Supreme Assembly, he looked a little better than that. And they had bought him some new clothes, and they actually fit on his reduced frame. But in any case, they are showing their own people that their revered general, the leader, is extremely ill, and I think are preparing them for a change. So I think we have to factor in maneuvering going on in the North, positioning to get ready for a change that could come, we don't know, but certainly within the next couple of years.
Thank you, Joe, so much for your call. Kim is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Kim.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the show. My photo group in Milwaukee had the privilege of watching and listening to Rick Wood from the Journal Sentinel show his photographs and talk about his photographs, and he did a big section on North Korea. He's one of the few photographers that has actually ever photographed there.
Uh-huh.
And the photos were fascinating. He really had some good stuff, and he managed to kind of sneak off a little bit a couple times, and you know, without being watched by anybody. And
yeah,
he got it was just unbelievable, and all the stories he told about how he got there and once he was there, and just really fascinating. And he does these public speaking things periodically. If anybody ever some group wants him, he's an outstanding speaker. And he was in New York City during 9/11, and he's got a lot of shots from there. And just really it was fascinating about North Korea. But one thing he said was that the people, a lot of the people that he talked to through interpreters and stuff, of course, but they were, the kind of the gist was that the people, most of the people were saying that they thought they were pretty lucky because they got one meal a day. And they heard that the people in South Korea only got one meal every 3 days.
Oh.
But anyway, I just wanted to say that. North Korea is fascinating. It'd be interesting if a bunch of social scientists could go there and just research the place because it's just, it's mind-boggling, just even seeing that in the photos. But anyway, thanks again for the show.
Thank you. Thanks, Kim.
Well, you know, we can't go to North Korea and do a real sociological study, but there are now 15 or 20,000 North Koreans who have immigrated, migrated, fled to South Korea, and some 100,000 or so living in China. And there have been studies, interviews with many of them, surveys about living conditions in the North while they were there, and propaganda and controls, etc. So we are getting gradually a pretty clear picture of how things work in the North through those refugees who have left the country. And some of those studies are available.
I'm not sure as a photographer I'd want to wander off on my own in that country. It might be a little unsafe, don't you think?
Yeah, whenever I would visit, they would always say, you know, don't take pictures without permission, and do not take pictures from moving vehicles. When we stop at a shrine or a monument or a place that we're visiting, then you may take pictures. And when you leave the country, they want to inspect the photographs that you've taken. In fact, digital photography is now welcomed in North Korea because they can go through your digital camera very quickly at the airport and look at every photograph you've taken, and they just hit the delete button, the ones they don't like.
That must be painful. All that work, and they got rid of my pictures.
Yeah, but still, people, as we just heard, are able to take photographs. And in my visits to North Korea, I should emphasize that I did visit quite a few times, about 20 times actually, and over the period of several years got to know a number of people a little better. I would regularly be with them for a couple of weeks, and they can be, you know, they have families, we exchange information, they can be very friendly. In a formal setting, in a meeting, sometimes they have to say, you know, the official line very strongly, and then later in the evening we might be having a beer and they're very relaxed. So these are people who probably think about their families first and how they're going to protect them, and if things change, how they're going to survive that change. And these are kind of people that we like to have engagement with. We like to invite them out of the country. We like to help them get ready for change that probably will be coming.
Kim, thank you so much for your call. We go to Michael next. Hi, Michael.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
Good. Okay.
Good.
Excuse me, I have a little cold, so if I cough, please excuse me. I'm also interested in the relationship between, the 50s and now, and does the Korean War have any residual effect or anything with the 38th parallel? I mean, did we part enemies at that point yet, or was there some kind of reconciliation between the West and North Korea? And my second question is, why are they so isolated and secretive? It kind of reminds me of China before maybe that was opened up to the West. And do you see any parallels there? And that's it.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah. The Korean War was a devastating war here on the Korean Peninsula, 1950 to 53. And it still has a strong psychological impact. And there was never a peace treaty. Basically, the fighting ended in a truce in 1953, and a demilitarized zone was established between the North and South, and a truce was signed by an American general representing the United Nations on one side, and by China and North Korea on the other. South Korea did not sign that and objected to it because they wanted, at that time, the president of South Korea, Syngman Rhee, wanted to continue fighting to try to unite the country. So right now we have a truce that's gone on for over 50 years, a demilitarized zone, which is heavily militarized now, so the war has never really been settled. The two states that exist on the Korean Peninsula were created as a result of World War II and the Cold War that immediately followed, and the line between the countries of, affiliated with the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc, and those countries associated with the West, ran right through Korea. And that line was created by Russia and the United States in order to separate their forces here in the Pacific. And it has never been removed. So that is the ultimate problem here that needs to be resolved. So, yes, the war still has... still resonates here.
And let's go next to Joe from Madison. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Kathleen. This is Joe, and I was in Korea with Ed, and I'm delighted to have you here on Madison Radio. And, Ed, the question I'd like to ask is, you know, Korea has vacillated back and forth. It's established a nuclear program, and then it's canceled it, and allowed inspectors in, and then it's canceled them. I wonder if you see any pattern that might be useful at this point, because several times it has agreed to terminate its program and allow inspectors in and destroy facilities, and then it has resumed them. So at this point, where it's sort of on the downside, what would you see as what needs to be done in order to get North Korea back on the track of stopping its program and demilitarizing?
Well, as soon as I heard that voice, I knew who it was.
Could you tell me, how do you know each other?
Korea together.
You what?
Joe Elder is a professor of sociology at the university.
Oh, sure.
And was my professor at one point, and then we traveled to North Korea together for the American Friends Service Committee back in 1991, I think it was.
That is correct, Ed.
Yeah, I do remember. And good. Your question is right to the point. What do we do, based on what we've learned from the past, what do we do now? One way of looking at it is that the regime in North Korea is not looking to self-destruct. Like regimes everywhere and states everywhere, they want to continue existing. Those in power want to maintain their privileges. They don't want to be... taken over by South Korea or whatever. And so what do they have to bargain with? In the past, they were part of the giant Soviet empire and had all of the backing of that, and now that has more or less disappeared. So they're bargaining with what they have, and that is they think that they're bargaining that they will not be dangerous to others. If you're good to us, we won't be dangerous. And... it appears, and it has been a consistent pattern, that they will agree to give up this position and to instead begin to modernize their economy and improve their lives for their people in exchange for regime survival. In other words, if they have another way, if they're convinced there's another way for North Korea to remain a separate state with its own leadership, without using threats to achieve that, they will accept that. And what they've said is the alternative they would accept is recognition by the United States and the rest of the world that it is a legitimate state. The U.S. would normalize relations with it, would have normal trade relations and lift sanctions, would open it up for development assistance from the World Bank and other sources, but in general wouldn't remove any idea that the United States might threaten the existence of North Korea. And so the bargaining has always been towards that, step by step. And when the North thinks it's about to get that, it gives way a bit. But when it looks like, when it feels that maybe the U.S. or the others are not really committed to recognizing its legitimacy, it backs off and demonstrates its belligerence. And I think that's why it's back and forth.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you, Joe, so much for calling. We're going to welcome more phone calls in just a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. And our guest is Professor Edward Reed. He's the Korea representative of the Asia Foundation and directs a program on international relations, partnerships for Asian development, and North Korea exchanges and trainings. He's worked in this part of the world for a number of years, starting back in 1970 when he was a Peace Corps volunteer in Korea. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the number 800-486-8655. Line is open, so join us now if you'd like. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, the author of a piece in Mother Jones, A Year Without a Mexican. Do you remember that show we did some time ago? I thought it was phenomenally interesting, about Postville, Iowa. And then last year, about this time, in May, I believe it was, there was a roundup of illegal workers at kosher meatpacking plant in Postville, Iowa. And the book looked at how this community, unlikely as it is, was a place for the world, and where different kinds of cultures were mixing in with people who live in Postville. Well, after the roundup, where a number of people were rounded up and put in jail and some sent back to Mexico, the town has changed quite dramatically. The meatpacking plant has changed quite dramatically, and we'll talk about, get an update of what's been happening in Postville, Iowa. So we look at immigration and a number of different issues, the second hour of our show today. Ed Reed is our guest now, Professor Reed, the Korea representative of the Asia Foundation, and we're talking about all the news from North Korea this week. And thank you, Joe, for the call. Let's go to Dave from Watertown next. Hello, Dave.
Hi.
Hi.
Comments, I guess. My son recently moved to South Korea, and he's teaching English at a place called Gumi, I think it's pronounced. I've never been there, but... he sends back quite a few pictures and some videos about just the town, and his comments and descriptions of the education system and the amount of hard work that they put into their education in South Korea.
Yeah.
I guess my own comment is if North Korea ever managed to shake this regime that seems to be just an anchor around their neck and was able to... merge with South Korea to form one Korea, I can't imagine the economic and political powerhouse that country could become. The other thing, as far as the United States telling any country to get rid of its nuclear weapons, that would include Korea, or telling Iran that they can't have nuclear weapons or everything else, it seems kind of kind of like, well, you first. I mean,
that's a good point.
We've got the biggest cookie jar in the world as far as nuclear weapons, and I would think that at least if we started in that direction of disarmament ourselves, maybe it would kind of lure some other countries into walking away from it.
Yeah.
And I'll take my answer. Take your comments off to the air. Thank you for letting me talk.
Thank you for calling, Dave.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dave, for that. On your last point, I must say that... when I heard President Obama announce his goal, or challenge us to take on the goal of abolishing all nuclear weapons, and that the U.S. would take leadership in that, I was extremely happy to hear that, and I know people in all over the world were. And I think if we help take the steps that he laid out, it would, as you say, put us on more solid ground to negotiate with others to get rid of these weapons. I'm very happy to hear that your son is teaching English here. There are thousands of Americans here teaching English and doing other jobs, and the relationship between South Korea and the United States is very tight, very close, and I feel very comfortable living here myself. It's a very fascinating, and as you say, a hardworking place. It's amazing how much time and resources Koreans put into education. Some people think maybe it's too much, but it certainly is one of the factors that's behind their remarkable and rapid modernization and growth. South Korea is now the 12th largest economy in the world. Now, side by side in the north is a failed economy. It's almost difficult to rank it, but and this is one of the
major problems looming in the future. As you say, North Koreans probably share some of the same talents and goals that those in the South have, and certainly that's great potential. But after two, three generations under a system that has kept people back from following their skills and incentives have all been all mixed up, it's going to be hard. If the border came down today, I think it would be very, very difficult to bring together the two sides for many reasons. I mentioned before about North Koreans who are now living in the South, refugees here. They have an extremely hard time integrating into South Korean society, and they even suffer discrimination from the South Koreans. And so it's going to be a major challenge for the next generation on the peninsula to somehow bring these two sides together. But again, they are all Koreans, and I think in the long run they'll be able to do it.
Professor Reed, please refresh my memory. Who's involved in the six-party talks?
The six parties are the U.S., South Korea, Japan, China, Russia, and North Korea.
Okay.
What
about his point, which I think is a valid one? It seems to me as though if you're a country that's involved in talks that does have nuclear weapons, that it's hard to persuade somebody to not advance down that road because you already have them. And what would make sense would be for the U.S. and Russia and other countries to make a very, very serious attempt at disarmament.
I agree. Three of those parties, the U.S., China, and Russia, are nuclear states. And they are remnants of the Cold War standoff. And of course, as I said, I completely welcome the initiative to move towards a total nuclear disarmament. The thing is, if we can get that going, in the meantime, we also have to try to prevent other states from from acquiring these weapons. And that's where North Korea comes in. One thing is, for example, after the nuclear test by North Korea in late 06, and now this couple of missile launches, every time this happens, in South Korea there's a more conservative group that calls for South Korea to acquire its own nuclear weapons and its own missiles to extend its missile range. Big news picture in the front page of newspapers here in South Korea today is their own missile, which will be launched in July to put their own real satellite into orbit. And it was rushed out for a photo op because, tit for tat. Japan is also, the right wing in Japan is taking advantage of this situation to press for remilitarization of Japan, for acquiring missiles and even nuclear weapons. So, yes, we need to, I believe, we have to move towards denuclearization of all countries and getting rid of nuclear weapons entirely. And meanwhile, we have to, in a situation like this in Northeast Asia, prevent the situation from getting worse while we move in that direction.
One more phone call. We have about a minute left. So, Scott from La Crosse, hi.
Hi there. I'll try to make this really brief.
Okay.
I was in Peace Corps in the 1970s in the South Pacific. Mm-hmm. And I worked in a library at a teacher's college, and we would get, seemingly on a monthly basis, these boxes of books from North Korea. And they were like, I mean, the best I could compare them to is like really expensive Bibles in this country, just like beautifully illustrated, all in English. This was, of course, during his father's reign. And we get these things by the box load, and we didn't have anything to do with them. Nobody wanted to read them. They were like collective speeches and all this. And even then I knew they were a poor country. And can you explain, like, what was going on with that?
Well, thank you very much. I know we just have a minute, but
right.
This was at the same time when they were using tens of thousands of dollars to purchase a full page in the New York Times to several times a year to proclaim the genius of Kim Il-sung, the leader, and make it look like this. And then they would repeat it back to their people that the New York Times had covered, you know, had recognized, the United States even recognized that the greatest genius in human history lived in North Korea. So I imagine mailing the books around the world also, they would whoever mailed those books would be able to report to their superiors that the works of Kim Il-sung were being read everywhere, even in the South Pacific.
So, it's a great story.
I'm sure that you must have leafed through it a little bit just to taste, you know, the genius of
Kim Il-sung. Thank you so much, Professor Reed, for being with us. It was you're clear as a bell in many ways. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. And I hope this has been useful to you.
It was great. Professor Reed, thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing the program and to John Treader.